This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. I invite anybody up in the balcony who wants to come down, although those are great seats, to come on down. Welcome this evening. When the telephone rang Sunday morning to say that Les Murray had illness in his family, I thought about that Yogi Berra quote. It was like deja vu all over again. And I thought, well, but this time it's easier because we knew that Dennis O'Driscoll was to come and interview Les, and he is one of the favorite people that any of us have ever met at the Lannan Foundation. He is our bro in Ireland, our co-conspirator, one of the best friends an organization or individuals could have. He also is one of the greatest poets from Ireland. Many of us had read a review of his work about a month ago that had appeared in a magazine called Slate, written by Adam Kirsch. A review of his work that was glowing and sparkling. We were very happy for Dennis and hoped that someday soon they could meet. And so they met sooner than they thought they were going to meet. Our wonderful staff, Christy Muswara Davis, Barbara Ventrello, and Joe Chapman worked pretty much nonstop, and in less than 24 hours, Adam had been contacted and was on his way to Santa Fe. We're getting good at this, but I have to tell you, we don't want it to happen anymore. It has never happened. It has happened once in the history of the reading program, which began in the early 90s in Los Angeles. So we've had two now. That's enough. And we're looking forward, June 25th, to Cornell West coming with Amy Goodman that night. Before Adam comes out to introduce Dennis, I just wanted to read a short poem that was found on the website for the Anvil Press, Dennis's publishers. And this is a poem written by his wonderful wife, Julie O'Callaghan, who is an American. And she knows Dennis better than anyone, but those of us who know him say this is exactly what we think he's like to be married to. It's called Bookworm. Opening a cabinet under the kitchen sink, I'm surprised to find you leaning against a water pipe reading Myth and Ted Hughes. I'm drying the dishes now and look out the window to see you raking mud with the TLS on the handle reading The Laureate of Ambiguity. How can you concentrate, I wonder, carpet sweeping a woven rug, polishing a doorknob, with a book in your other hand reading Language, You Terrible Surrounder. Even when you're sleeping, your dreams are literary. Walking up a steep, dark staircase, books, like bats, were flying at your head. Reading the titles out loud saved you. As I point the car towards work, you sit beside me with American Poetry Review. Everyone is tired, waiting in a traffic jam. I break and honk and swear, but you are reading Words Are Everywhere. It's a pleasure to have Dennis here. Words Are Everywhere with Dennis. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Thanks very much for coming. I know that Dennis is very sorry that Les Murray couldn't be here with us tonight, but I have to admit that I'm glad because it gives us the opportunity to hear Dennis read his poetry and to talk with him, because I think he's one of the best and most interesting poets writing now. In Ireland, where he's a leading figure as a poet and a critic, he wouldn't need an introduction, but let me just give you a few details about him. He's the author of 6 books of poetry: Kissed, Hidden Extras, Long Story Short, Quality Time, Weather Permitting, which was a recommendation of the Poetry Book Society and shortlisted for the Irish Times Poetry Prize, and most recently, Exemplary Damages, which was published last year by Anvil Press. He's also a widely published critic of poetry, and his essays are collected in Troubled Thoughts, Majestic Dreams, which was named by Seamus Heaney as one of his favorite books of 2002. He received a Lannan Literary Award in 1999, and he was recently named to the Irish government's Committee for the Centenary of Bloomsday, which is the day in 1904 that's immortalized in James Joyce's Ulysses. There's one other important thing to know about Denis O'Driscoll, and until I met him yesterday, it was the only thing that I knew about him personally. The back cover of each of his books says that he has worked for the Irish Civil Service since the age of 16. Today, he's a high-ranking official in the Irish Customs Service, and probably the only poet ever to appear on the cover of Ireland's Tax News magazine. But this is more than just an oddity from his resume. Knowing about his day job is much more important with Denis than with most poets, because he's the poet after Philip Larkin who's made the most of his job both as a subject for his poetry and as a part of his identity as a poet. With compassion and subversive wit, he uses work, the routines and objects of everyday office life, to examine the standardized and globalized life that most of us lead in America as well as Ireland. In fact, the most startling thing about him to an American reader is how different he is from what we usually think of as an Irish poet. Unlike W.B. Yeats or Seamus Heaney, who in different ways remind us of Ireland's difference, O'Driscoll dwells on its sameness. His poetry makes Dublin seem like a version of New York or London. In his essay, Foreign Relations, Irish and International Poetry, he throws cold water on what he calls the romantic view that Ireland is awash with inspired and instinctive poets whom even the gentlest of critical tools would wound. Instead, he embraces what he calls a global regionalist perspective, which is, and I quote, alert to the political, economic, and environmental upheavals which uproot people and force them into new imaginative relationships with their native places. In his poetry, as he has written, the global village casts light on the deserted village. This alertness has helped O'Driscoll write with sharpness and accuracy about the life actually led by his readers. When he describes what people like him and people like us do with their days, he always seems to be asking incredulously, "You mean you really care about that? Do you genuinely feel proud of your tooled leather and buff teak hands-on management techniques, line logistics, and voicemail? Do you take pleasure in your charge card orders or own-brand bargains in suburban shopping malls?" Behind these consumer pleasures, he always sees the human cost of work, which he describes in one poem, paraphrasing Joyce, as the nightmare from which we yearn to awaken. That is why O'Driscoll's best poem about having a job is really a poem about Job, so that the title is momentarily suspended between the two senses of the word. This has been a major theme for poets ever since Wordsworth, who complained that getting and spending we lay waste our powers. But in Denis O'Driscoll's case, his skepticism about the world of work is complicated by the fact that he is both inside and outside of that world. What he does as a civil servant, he observes as a poet. For any poet, the big question is what to do when you're not writing poetry, which is most of the time. And speaking strictly as a reader, I get the sense that for O'Driscoll, again very much like Philip Larkin, who had a very successful career as a librarian, spending that time in an office is the best choice precisely because it draws a clear line between life and work, or between work and the poet's real work, which is, of course, what the outside world sees as unreal play. If work is O'Driscoll's favorite subject, it seems to me that his true theme is death. Many of his poems are about the deaths of friends and family members, about visits to hospitals, about the strange fact that every single person will eventually die. It seems fitting that one of his best poems is inspired by the fact that his house overlooks an old graveyard. But few poets write about death with so much wit and resignation and so little sentimentality. As he writes in Mistaken Identity, a moving poem about the victim of a terrorist attack, "I accepted death as I accepted life, as something to get on with." More important, the subject of illness and death provoke him to his most unexpected and surprising uses of language. In the metaphysical poetry of the 17th century, death was considered the most fertile mother of wit. That's because wit involves shocking juxtaposition, and there's no more shocking juxtaposition than that of death and life. As T.S. Eliot wrote, it takes a strange kind of wit to be able to see the skull beneath the skin, or, as Denis O'Driscoll writes, to see the dead woman in the living girl. It takes a poet of unusual honesty and intelligence to make us feel this nearness, which we spend so much time trying to forget. That is why, for me at least, the best and wittiest moments in his poetry are the darkest. Few poets have written so piercingly and compassionately about our mortality. What I admire most about Denis O'Driscoll's poetry is that it makes me feel that, by comparison, most other poets are forcing things a little, striving for effect. He seems to write directly and honestly about the things that are closest to us, and for that very reason go unobserved. how we actually feel about our work and our possessions, about love, aging, and death. I think he's one of the most exciting of contemporary poets because of his intelligence, wit, and quickness of perception, his seriousness, and his serious comedy. That's why I'm looking forward so much to the reading we're about to hear, and why I'm honored to introduce Dennis O'Driscoll.
I just took out Arthur Z's books, which doesn't seem right. When you publish a book called Weather Permitting, I think you get what you deserve in terms of weather. And what it unfortunately does to Santa Fe is it brings Irish weather with it, which is even worse. So I apologize for the weather, and I apologize for not being Les Murray, and just about anything else that I can be blamed for. Sometime in the 1980s, I think it was in the early 80s, I wrote an article about Australian poetry, which I commended three Australian poets in particular, A.D. Hope, Les Murray, and Kevin Hart. And the heading that I put on the piece was, Take Hope, Take Heart, Take Murray. And last Sunday, when I rang John Evans and Joe Chapman and the Lannan Foundation, with the sad news that Les Murray wouldn't be able to travel for this evening, they did not allow this to cause them to lose hope or to lose heart. They did lose Murray, of course, but that's another matter. It was an early Sunday morning in Santa Fe, and I'm sure they had other plans, but they immediately, with that elan and efficiency that we associate with Lannan, they set about finding a substitute. And the real substitute tonight is, of course, Adam Kirsch. And for reasons which will become apparent to you in the future, if they're not already apparent, you will remember this evening for Adam Kirsch because he is, in many decades, I think, the most important American poet critic to emerge with refreshing honesty and intelligence and discrimination, which have never really been more needed when I think poetry is in danger of asphyxiation from hyperbole of blurbs and insider dealing of all kinds. So I want to thank Adam Kirsch for what he's done at such short notice, and of course the aforesaid Lannan Foundation. There are Irish Americans that are getting less of them. And to thank also, of course, Christy and Barbara, who are both involved in organizing this strange and belated event. I really am sorry not to be Les Murray for more reasons than one, because I think he's an infinitely more talented person than I am. I think I'm to read for 40 minutes, and I'm reminded of what Mary Heaney said. She said, there's no such thing as a short poetry reading. So I wish I could do something to shorten it, but we shall see. Actually, I just remember something Adam Kirsch said in one of his articles. He said that what matters about poetry is the poem on the page. The rest is showbiz. So I do really thank you for coming through that awful weather, and for I'm sure you thought it was Les Murray you were coming to, but we'll start with a poem which, in fact, has a showbiz angle to it, because it appeared in the April issue of Oprah Winfrey's magazine, O. Not a place I expect it to be any more than I expect it to be right here, right now. April was Poetry Month, and she, or they, selected a poem to publish. And this is a version that I did of a Polish poet called Wisława Szymborska, who won the Nobel Prize a few years ago. I was a great admirer of hers long before she won the Nobel Prize, so Adam Kirsch is relying on my futurology in his case as well. This one is called The 120 Pub. It's a sort of loose version of a poem about terrorism that Szymborska wrote. The 120 Pub. The bomb is primed to go off at 120. A time check, 116. There's still a chance for some to join the pub's ranks, for others to drop out. The terrorist watches from across the street. Distance will shield him from the impact of what he sees. A woman, turquoise jacket on her shoulder, enters. A man with sunglasses departs. Youths in T-shirts loiter without intent. 1:17:04. The scrawny motorcyclist, revving up to leave, won't believe his luck. But the tall man walks straight in. 1:17:40. That girl over there with the Walkman, now the bus has cut her off. 1:18 exactly. Was she stupid enough to head inside, or wasn't she? We'll know before long when the dead are carried out. It's 1:19. Nothing much to report until a muddled barfly hesitates, fumbles with his pockets, and, like a blasted fool, stumbles back at 1:19:50 to retrieve his goddamned cap. 1:20. How time drags when? Any moment now. Not yet. Yes, yes, there it goes. It's strange. I mean, Adam mentioned a terrorism poem that I've written as well, but obviously the backdrop to doing versions or to writing a lot of these was Ireland and Ulster. And, of course, it's a topic one hears discussed in an American context more and more, and it's, I suppose, any topic that's true for a poem, sadly, can be universal for negative as well as positive reasons. I'm going to read a poem now which was in my first book, and it's called Someone. And there was a national day of mourning in Ireland for September the 11th, when all offices and businesses closed down. And the Irish radio station, which I can't pronounce because I'm not able to pronounce, according to Joe Chapman, one of the letters in it, so I won't, had a program for the September the 11th with a lot of Irish singers mostly, Sinead O'Connor and Chris de Burgh and John Hurt, the actor, and so on. And they asked me to read a poem, and I read this poem, which seemed to fit on the day. The idea of the poem is that you're getting up for work, you're going about your business in the ordinary way, and who would believe that this, in fact, was your last day or your final moments, as happened on September 11th. Someone is dressing up for death today, a change of skirt or tie, eating a final feast of buttered slice pan, tea, scarcely having noticed the erection that was his last, shaving his face to marble for the icy laying out, spraying with deodorant her coarse armpit grass. Someone today is leaving home on business, saluting terminally the neighbours who will join in the cortege. Someone is trimming his nails for the last time, a precious moment. Someone's thighs will not be streaked with elastic in the future. Someone is putting out milk bottles for a day that will not come. Someone's fresh breath is about to be taken clean away. Someone is writing a check that will be marked drawer deceased. Someone is circling posthumous dates on a calendar. Someone is listening to an irrelevant weather forecast. Someone is making rash promises to friends. Someone's coffin is being sanded, laminated, shined, who feels this morning quite as well as ever. Someone, if asked, would find nothing remarkable in today's date. Perfume and goodbyes, her final will and testament. Someone today is seeing the world for the last time, as innocently as he had seen it first. I don't know if you can follow my pronunciations as well as my accents, but if you have any problems, don't hesitate. This is a sort of related poem called 3 a.m. I was well awake at 3 a.m. this morning, but that's only because I was living Irish time. But normally, if the telephone rings at 3 a.m., it's probably not very good news. So if we're on the bad news, we might as well keep it up. 3 a.m. This is somebody actually making a phone call at 3 a.m. I'll give him a minute longer before I break the news. another minute of innocence and rest. He's in the thicket of dreams he will still be struggling with as he stirs himself to take my call, wondering who in Christ's name this could be. One more minute then to let him sleep through what he's just about to wake to. I feel a bit like a poetic terrorist myself, spreading terror to the audience, but we'll have one more before we finish. This is the one that Adam was referring to. It's called Mistaken Identity. It's a kind of a mock interview with... it was a big thing in Northern Ireland, and sadly, I suppose, in terrorism worldwide, where sometimes innocent bypassers are killed, and sometimes people are targeted, but in fact they're the wrong people they've targeted. And this was just one such example in Ireland. And because, I suppose, all these events are turned into kind of media things as well, I wrote this as a kind of prose poem, which is an interview. Somebody is purporting to interview this person who doesn't really have anything very significant to say because he was just going about his business. Mistaken identity. Could I begin by asking what you were thinking of as the gunman approached? Nothing very precise, actually. I was vaguely annoyed at pet owners. It's not fair to those who walk the streets. I'm nearly sure I had a flash of memory also. Something reminded me of the nest under the yew at my grandmother's. We found a clutch of warm fawn eggs one summer there. A woman too, I think, a belt tied loosely round her waist. Yes, that's right. She proved to be a key witness. I just recalled the way the hens would tap their legs like tuning forks, then hold their drawling notes long into the afternoon. My grandmother was always making things, knitting or crochet or baking, peach flans, seed cakes, raspberry meringues. What kind of fear did you experience as the killer was about to strike? I was a bit behind in my work. A few times in the last month or so, a pain had flared down my left thigh. Fear that the eldest would go near the quarry again, that our new video might be robbed during the holidays. Can you describe how you felt after you learned the news? It was a kind of reverse dream. You know how when you dream that you've done something with someone or to someone, as it often is, you expect them to remember the experience too. I once flew under the waves with the kids, viewing candy-striped fish from the cockpit. This time, it is they who have the details. I don't remember any of it. The shot, the emulsion of blood, the surgeon, the dizzy lowering into the clay, the statement about mistaken identity. What would you like one more sight of? The family, of course. My record rack. A girl in tennis dress. A sky aerated with stars. Swallows in summer that pedal uphill, then freewheel down. A blackbird on my front lawn, charming worms. Sparks of moonlight kindling a tree. More ordinary things. The Sunday lunch as it is served. The steaming gold of roast potatoes and chicken skin. The shirts folded after ironing. A running bath. Any regrets? That we are as similar in death as life, clustered here under the same headstones. But, to tell the truth, I never wanted to stand out. I would hate to have seen those newspaper reports with my name in them, and the neighbours no doubt saying how quiet I was, and the bishop praying for my soul, and the police confirming I had no subversive connections. Anything else you miss? The smell of life given off by the earth that I have no nose for here. Those transparent moments at bedtime nothing had prepared me to expect. The sports results. Finally, do you forgive your killer? I accept death as I accepted life as something to get on with. Just thinking of poems that find their moment after you write them, this is one of the many irreverent poems that I've written, and it's actually topical now for the SARS, actually. I was going to a meeting of an organization called Eurocustoms in Madrid, and I was lucky enough to be sitting beside somebody who sneezed on me the whole way to Madrid. So I, as it were, sneezed the opportunity and wrote this revenge poem called Germ Warfare. It's just about, I'm in negotiations with the World Health Organization. We might get this one up on their website. Germ Warfare. As saints kissed lepers' sores, caressed rank beggars' wounds, I ought to thank God for the way you spray me with your germs, my fellow travelers. I should take it like a seraph, or at least like a man, ingest your pestilence with relish, meditate indulgently on sprinklers dousing a striped lawn, feel proud to hothouse your viruses in my lungs, pick up stray bugs like hitchhikers, pets seeking a good home. So, by all means, go on sneezing in that spunky style of yours. The convulsion, the eruption, the paroxysm, the pile drive, the dog yelp, the orgasm, the gale force, the squelch, the cut short, the sudden break, the snort, the screech owl. Let it all hang out, therefore, whatever it happens to be. You with the unprotected schnoz, as though a hanky's prophylactic would sin against your principles, your faith. You who pass your plague around like cough drops, you can be relied upon to prop yourself beside me on the bus, telling your cell phone how much you suffer as you present me with hard evidence, certain that a problem shared is a problem halved. The morning before the long plane journey, the crucial interview, the special date, whenever hoarseness begins to tighten round my throat like a noose, thoughts wander back to you, eyes water, touched by the largesse with which you showered me, smitten to the core by your infectious charms. Bless you. Michael Wiegers, who's here, recently edited a book of poems by poets about poetry. So this is another poem from my much maligned first collection. All the maligning comes from me, by the way. It's called Purloch. It was actually, I'd sometimes be at work and I'd get a good idea for a poem and there would be nothing I could do about it and I'd forget it later on. So I called it Purloch after, you remember in Kublai Khan, where Coleridge said that a person from Purloch had interrupted the writing of the poem. I think he turned Kublai Khan into Kublai Kant. This is Purloch. All I could think to do was to write a kind of elegy for all these incredibly brilliant poems that I had forgotten. So the poems are a bit like the fish. It's always the big ones that get away. Purloch. It's a very slight poem, by the way, but anyway, we'll have it. This is the best poem I have never written. It is composed of all the stunning lines I thought of, but lacked the time or place or paper to jot down. This is a poem of distractions, interruptions, clamoring telephones. This is a poem that reveals how incompatible with verse my life is. This is a home for mentally lapsed poems. This is the lost property office of poetry. This is my poem without a hero, conceived but never born. This is a prisoner of consciousness, a victim of intelligence leaks. This is the poem that cannot learn itself by heart. This is the poem that has not found its individual voice. This is the poem that has forgotten its own name. This is my most unmemorable creation. These are my most disposable lines. This is the poem that dispenses with words. I have one other for Michael. Poem about poetry. This is in prose, set out in good, honest-to-God prose. It's a kind of anti-poem. I think a lot of the things that I write are anti-poems. Marianne Moore, I suppose, is the great anti-poet, and I'm very pro-anti-poet. This one is called The Next Poem. and it's a poem for anybody who has sat through the non-short poetry readings that Mary Heaney was talking about. The next poem. My next poem is quite short, and it's about something most of you will recognize. It came out of an experience I had on vacation a couple of years ago. In fact, I'm pretty sure I'm correct in saying it's the only poem I ever managed to write during a vacation. If you could have called this a vacation, it bore all the hallmarks of an endurance test. There's a reference in the poem to roller canaries, which become more or less mythical birds in the last line. I hope the context will make that clear. Incidentally, this poem has gone down extremely well in Swedish translation, which maybe reveals something about me. Now, a word I'd better gloss is schizont. If I can locate the slip of paper, I'll give you the dictionary definition. Yes, here we are. A cell formed from the trapezoid during the asexual stage of the life cycle of protozoans of the class Sporozoa. Okay then, I'll read this and just two or three more sequences before I finish. By the way, I should perhaps explain that the title is in quotations. It's something I discovered in a book on early mosaics. I wanted to get across the idea of diversity and yet unity at the same time, especially with an oriental, as it were, orientation. And I need hardly tell this audience which of my fellow poets is alluded to in the phrase dainty mountaineer in the second section. Anyway, here it is. Oh, I nearly forgot to mention that the repetition of the word naui is deliberate. As I said, it's quite short. And you have to picture it set out in the page as five sonnet-length trapezoids. Here's the poem. I'd better read something with pretense to being a real poem, I suppose. This is a poem called Fruit Salad. I'm actually reading over all my old poems at the moment, which is why you're getting more of them than you ought for a new and selected. And it's extraordinary to read over old poems because they might as well have been written by somebody else. And more often than not, you know, somebody said that most poets outlive their own reputations, but I think a lot of their own poems outlive the poet's affections as well, is another matter. Anyway, this one is called Fruit Salad, and it's I love fruit, and especially strawberries, and I have these fantasies that only, I think, pregnant women are supposed to have, which is kind of off-season in the middle of an Irish winter. You get a sudden longing for a strawberry. And I used to have in my office a huge photograph of a strawberry, actually. Better than having a raspberry, I suppose. Fruit salad. There's just a little section on the peach. We're not very exotic in Ireland, I'm afraid. The peach, the strawberry, the pear, the apple, and a fruit shop. I don't know why I'm reading this, but it came up next year. Fruit salad. Peach. There's not much point in trying to cultivate a sultry peach of words. Just pass me one to stroke, to eat, or paint it from a glowing palette. Colors dart from apricot to apple, flames licking velvet hide. Hold its downy, yielding roundness. Fondle its lightly clothed contours. Taste its golden mean, its sweetness, before it starts to shrink and shrivel, starts to wrinkle like a passion fruit. Strawberry. Strawberries with whipped cream, a sunset ripple on your plate, a chordate locket, a precious stone. Cut one and expose the marbled core, the wholesome rubicundity of outdoors, not the hothouse plastic of tomatoes. Compact, meaty, flecked with seeds, the bracts a garnish, parsley on beef, verdant ferns in a bouquet of roses. A July day provides the ideal accompaniment, lazy as the cream dripping from the whisk. Pear. Most easily hurt of fruits, bruising under a matte coat of skin, smooth as bath soap inside, halved a perfectly stringed lute. It hangs in a shaft of autumn light, timeless as a bronze cathedral bell, or disturbs the peace and drops a hand grenade, pin still intact, a toppling shell of glycerine. We take refuge from our troubles in its syrup, wasps burrowing through heady pulp. Apple. This is for Adam. All apples lead back to that first temptation. Trees behind the thatched farmhouse, forbidden fruit, a warts and all beauty, pupating in pink silk blossom, then fired and glazed in summer, brushed by a red admiral's wings, wine-dipped like nectarines or green as nettles, stinging with tart knowledge. Bite the way back to a primal silence, eurythmic crunch, shutting out the world, digesting its hard truths. Fruit chop. Orange skins baked to a crust, fluffy whiteness underneath. Raspberries like bleeding gums, melons whose haunches are tested for ripeness. I buy bananas racked like chops and apricots, one blemished with a spot which I'll slice off, cheddar flesh wholesome again. I pinch a bulbous, plum-sized grape. Lemons tumble from an opened crate. Adam was talking about the way that, I suppose, modern Ireland is represented in work of different poets, but one of the issues that you really have to come to terms with in Ireland for both political and, I suppose, for personal and sociological reasons is religion, because it's just so fundamental, good word, to everything in the country. And religions are very divisive, of course, in a lot of respects, but at the same time, they're a very intense way of experiencing the world, and I think a lot of ancient learning and so on is there. But predictably, I had the very, very strict Catholic upbringing. And this poem is called Missing God, and it's kind of missing in... There's that missing God, the absent God, and there's that sense of missing God in a secular society. And there's, I suppose, the nostalgic sense of missing God as well. Because you learn through religions, I mean, irrespective of what they are, to read the world in a kind of sacramental way. So whether you believe or you don't believe, you go on, I mean, just see, say in the Christian tradition, I suppose, you see a glass of wine and a couple of rolls on a table, and immediately it intensifies that experience. Missing God, it's 3 pages long, I'm afraid. His grace is no longer called for before meals. Farmed fish multiply without his intercession. Bread production rises through disease-resistant grains devised scientifically to mitigate his faults. Yet, though we rebelled against him like adolescents, uplifted to see an oppressive father banished, a bearded hermit to the desert, we confess to missing him at times. Miss him during the civil wedding, when, at the blossomy altar of the registrar's desk, we wait in vain to be fed a line containing words like everlasting and divine. Miss him when the TV scientist explains the cosmos through equations, leaving our planet to revolve on its axis aimlessly, a wheel skidding in snow. Miss him when the radio catches a snatch of plain chant from some echoey priory. When the gospel choir raises its collective voice to ask, shall we gather at the river? Or the forces of the oratorio converge on, I know that my Redeemer liveth, and our contracted hearts lose a beat. Miss him when a choked voice at the crematorium recites the poem about fearing no more the heat of the sun. Miss him when we stand in judgment on a lank crucifixion in an art museum, its stripe-like ribs testifying to rank. Miss him when the gamma rays recorded on the satellite graph seem arranged into a celestial score, the music of the spheres, the Ave Verum Corpus of the observatory lamp. Miss him when we stumble on the breast lump for the first time and an involuntary prayer crosses our lips. When a shadow crosses our bodies on an X-ray screen, when we receive a transfusion of foaming blood sacrificed anonymously to save life. Miss him when we call out his name spontaneously in awe or anger, as a woman in the birth ward bawls her long-dead mother's name. Miss him when the linen-covered dining table holds warm bread rolls, shiny glasses of red wine. Miss him when a dove swoops from the orange grove in a tourist village, just as the monastery bell begins to take its toll. Miss him when our journey leads us under leaves of Gothic tracery, an arch of overlapping branches that meet like hands in Michelangelo's creation. Miss him when, trudging past a church, we catch a residual whiff of incense, a perfume on par with the fresh-baked loaf which Miwash compared to happiness. Miss him when the sun makes its way through the stained glass window of the fake antique lounge bar. Miss him when our newly decorated kitchen comes in shaker style and we order a matching set of Mother Anne Lee chairs. Miss him when we listen to the prophecy of astronomers that the visible galaxies will recede as the universe expands. Miss him the way an uncoupled glider riding the evening thermals misses its tug. Miss him as the lovers shrugging shoulders outside the cheap hotel ponder what their next move should be. Even feel nostalgic odd days for his second coming, like standing in the brick dome of a dovecote after the birds have flown. I feel I should read a poem about rain, but maybe we won't tempt fate just yet. Here's a six-line poem that proves that poetry can be popular and profitable. Some insurance company in England wrote to me last year and offered me, a four-figure sum to write a very short poem to be used in an advertisement. But they wouldn't tell me what the product was. So I wasn't quite that venal, and I wouldn't do it. So then wrote to me and said that could they use an existing poem? And I said, well, it depends on what you're going to do with it. And they said they were going to use it on an advertisement for life insurance, which makes me wonder if Adam isn't onto something in talking about me as death as a subject, after all. I might be an actuarial expert in poetry. So they used this six-line poem, but I was very careful about it. Mind you, I still did do it, so I was corrupted. But it was a poem that was already in print, and there's a phrase in it which is immersion heater. You probably don't know what they are. They're so primitive where we are. It's a thing you use to heat up the water if you're going to have a bath or a shower or something. It's six lines long, and... I won't name the insurance company. Home. When all is said and done, what counts is having someone you can phone at 5 to ask for the immersion heater to be switched to bath and the pizza taken from the deep freeze. I got my money easily, as you can see. This is a poem called Middle Class Blues, another kind of home poem. He has everything. A beautiful young wife, a comfortable home, a secure job, a velvet three-piece suite, a metallic silver car, a mahogany cocktail cabinet, a rugby trophy, a remote-controlled music center, a set of golf clubs under the hall stand, a fair-haired daughter learning to walk. What he is afraid of most, and what keeps him tossing some nights on the electric under-blanket, listening to the antique clock clicking with disapproval from the landing, are the stories that begin. He had everything. A beautiful young wife, a comfortable home, a secure job. Then one day, cushier. Do you know what cushier means? It's something's easier. It's much cushier. I had a friend who was a Czech poet called Miroslav Holub, who became very, very friendly, and so friendly that he allowed me to half write this poem. He had written this poem and he was never satisfied with it, and I said, could I finish it off? And he said, if you can. So this is our joint effort. It's called Experimental Animals. It's much cushier. He was a scientist, by the way, Holub. He was an immunologist. So this is actually about working with animals in a laboratory. It's much cushier when it's raining rabbits than cats and dogs. The animals for experiment should not betray too much intelligence. It grows unnerving to watch their actions mimic yours. Terror and horror you can empathize with. But for a real heartbreak, take a newborn pig, fantastically ugly, possessing nothing and desiring nothing except its swig of milk. Legs warping under all that weight of uselessness, stupidity, and snout. When I must kill a piglet, I hesitate a while, for about 5 or 6 seconds, in the name of all the beauty of the world, in the name of all the sadness of the world. What's keeping you? Someone bursts in then. Or I burst in on myself. 2 to go. So I have to literally take the next 2. One of them is to be read for Frank Lawler. There's a little lullaby for a stillborn child. It's set in May. Stillborn. What we are lamenting is what has not been, and what will not have seen this mild May morning. What we are lamenting is unsuckled air, and what was brought to bear this mild May morning. What we are lamenting is our flesh and blood, this child that has not laughed or cried this mild May morning. What we are lamenting is the life we crave, snatched from the cradle to the grave this mild May morning. Somebody quoted that actually in a obituary column in the newspaper I was very touched. The last poem is Frank Lawler. It's one of my really tasteless poems. It's about illness. But, I mean, it's a poem written with nothing except compassion. But it's so hard to write directly about compassion, with compassion about even illness, without sounding sentimental or without just repeating what has been said before. So this is just a poem. Somebody actually used it in a hospital in Ireland, which I can't believe, and I did everything to dissuade them in Waterford Regional Hospital. And probably it was a ploy to get the people out of the physical unit into the psychiatric unit. It's called Saturday Night Fever. Playing tonight at the X-rated club, the chemotherapies, drugged to the gills, the lead singer's pate modishly bald. And who will your partner be? Alzheimer, the absent-minded type, with the retro gear, everything a perfect mismatch. Huntington, grooving his hippie-hippie shake routine. Thrombosis, the silly clot, trying to pull a stroke. Angina, who can be such a pain, and yet is all heart. Reno, decked in ice blue, coolest kid around. Dear sweet emphysema, so exercised, she hardly has a chance to catch her second wind. Cancer, the rogue, ever gregarious, spreading himself around, groping his way niftily to a breast. Parkinson, who is already restless for the next number. They sweat it out all night under the lightning strikes of strobe lights, flashing like an ambulance. Such fun that nobody, as they groan with pleasure, dreams of sleep. I'm going to have to end with something else. That's terrible. No. I'll end with this little poem called Nocturne. I'd normally regard adding a poem to a program as a punishment, but I think I couldn't end on that note. There's a little end-of-evening poem called Nocturne. It mentions a Chinese poet called Dao Qian, who has been translated by Arthur Z, whose work you will know. Nocturne. Time for sleep. Time for a nightcap of grave music, a dark nocturne, a late quartet, a parting song, bequeathed by the great dead in perpetuity. I catch a glance sometimes of my own dead at the window, those whose traits I share. Thin as moths, as matchsticks, they stare into the haven of the warm room, eyes ablaze. It is Sunday, a lifetime ago. A woman in a now-demolished house sings Michael Row the Boat Ashore as she sets down the bucket with its smooth folds of drinking water. The steady harvest moon out there, entangled in the willows' stringy hair, directs me home like Dao Qian. A caged bird pines for its first forest. A salmon thirsts for its stream. Thank you for coming. That's it.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Conversation part of the evening, and I'm filling Dennis's role as the conversant. And I'm very glad because I have a lot of questions to ask, although I understand you had actually reams of questions to ask Les Murray. I don't have quite that many.
We thought of having a reading of the questions only tonight, but...
So we'll get illumination about you instead. Uh-huh. And I'm glad you read the poem, the next poem, because, in fact, just a few weeks ago I was at a reading where a woman told us that the poem was laid out in stanzas on alternate sides of the page, and to illustrate this, she actually leaned from one side of the podium to the next. And I thought of that, of your poem in the heaven. Well, maybe we could start talking about something that you discuss very comically and funnily in your poem, The Celtic Tiger, which is about the sort of Europeanization of Ireland, and it's a list of the sort of trendy and modish things that you can see people doing, the foods they're eating. Mm. Is that something that you've actually witnessed in the last few years?
Yeah, I see. The time when you notice things is when it's changing. All the things you take for granted, obviously, you would never think to write about. But it's actually quite exciting time to be in Ireland in terms of social change because, to personalize it, my grandmother, for instance, who died in the 1970s, had no electricity. It had still not quite reached her house. And when I was growing up, running water hadn't reached our house. So at no stage of my childhood did we have running water. We learned how to wash, mind you, but just about. And we had no telephone, for instance. We had no fridge, no anything. And it wasn't in any sense a deprived upbringing. That was how it was. And you took it for granted. And I suppose there are people who look back in 2003 and think, well, our grandparents still had flat-screen televisions in those days, you know. And so when you watch all this happening in front of you, it happened with incredible speed, really. And in a way, that Missing God poem, I suppose, is touching on that. Moving from a kind of very... almost East European society. It was funny, when I went exactly 10 years ago this month to Romania to be translated, and to be translated into Romania as much as Romanian. And they all said I was a very typical Romanian poet of the 1980s, which I knew I was something, but I hadn't known that I was a typical Romanian poet of the 1980s. And we were talking about our upbringings, and of course theirs was much more deprived, but like, for instance, we would have been in the Legion of Mary and they were in the Young Pioneers. We were all doing kind of similarly ideologically uplifting things and enjoying them too. And so therefore, when modernity strikes a country, as it does Ireland, I think there's a tremendous amount to be written about that and a huge amount to be observed. But you don't want to be just sociological about it. You have to somehow find the language to do that. And you also wonder what will happen to the literary culture afterwards, because part of what makes Irish... Well, I think there are probably two things. Maybe you had this as a question, but I'm answering... I'm beginning to interview myself now, which is even worse. You see, I was hired to be the interviewer, remember, so... I think maybe two very distinctive things about Irish literary culture would be, one, that it was very close to the Irish language, because most people would have been native speakers into the 18th century. So that ghost of the language is there, and the religious thing is there, so a kind of a numinous sense of the sacred is very strong. So in the kind of secularized, materialized, much better off, and in many respects, much happier Ireland. I mean, I'm all for people having a drop of running water once in a while. For good poetical reasons, maybe not, but going to the well, it makes good poetry, but it doesn't always make for good living. And for instance, our neighbours, when I grew up in Tipperary, all went to the well for water. We were one up, we had a pump. So when your society then loses touch more and more with the Gaelic language, when it becomes more secularized in religious terms, it would be quite interesting to see what will happen to Irish literature. My own prediction is it will actually lose most of what it has, will lose most of the cachet it has, and will become like literature is everywhere else. And that, too, has advantages and disadvantages.
Well, it seems to me that you have a biographical piece, a couple of memoir pieces in your essay collection, and one of them you talk about how, as a schoolboy, you were assigned to write essays about a day on the bog, about what it was like to work on the bog, and you're very cynical about that exercise and talk about how it was expected that you would praise working on the bog, but in fact, you knew even then that working on the bog was not such a great thing. And yet, at the same time, you write also very acutely about the sort of false consolations of middle-class life and urban life, and you have poems in which you list the things that people look forward to and the things that they take pleasure in, and basically end by saying, is that all there is? Is that good enough? And that seems like a religious impulse in some way as well, that whatever we can have in the world, although you're not disparaging it, is not enough somehow.
Mm. Yeah, I was thinking recently, actually, of... something that they say, Exemplary Damages, the title of the latest book, is a bit sardonic about the way that humans always try to compensate people for things, and that Ireland is more and more referred to as a compensation culture, or a compo culture, they call it, where people are finding holes to fall into and then finding people to sue who allegedly put the holes that they allegedly fell into, and so on. So you have these endless court cases of people looking for compensation. And I was thinking that actually, take the word culture out of compensation culture and take the word compensation. In a way, it's not a bad definition for poetry, is that poetry is compensation culture. Is culture, compensation in that it... I think most of the reasons why we read poetry or write poetry really, in one sense or another, have to do with compensation, that we're compensating ourselves for loss. We're compensating ourselves for fear of loss, I mean, often in a celebratory mood. Like, the most intense moment of love is always shadowed by loss, by this not lasting, and so on. And therefore, I think a lot of what poetry is about is trying to... I think it's Wallace Stevens who said that poetry is a response to the daily necessity of getting the world right. I think you're constantly... In fact, I think your poet was quite right to be leaning both ways, because I think it's very hard to get balance in life and in perspective. And I think poetry is like something that's always trying to momentarily hold the balance and to compensate for those things that make us sway in either direction. And there's a French poet called Yves Bonfoy, and he's always talking about poetry giving you presence. And I think what he means is that there's a kind of memory in all of us, at least we think it's a memory, of unity with the world. It's why people are often nostalgic about childhood. And I think poetry, in some respects, is an attempt to regain that unity. And Bonnefoy is very good on that. And you see, poetry isn't just words. I mean, this is why literary theory is absolutely barking up the wrong tree on poetry, because, as Bonnefoy says in one of his essays, like, the word tree, you know, refers to a tree, obviously, but in poetry, it is placed in a different kind of context. It takes on a rhythm, becomes partly song, it becomes partly charm, it becomes all kinds of things. And there is definitely a bit of voodoo in poetry, and it is that attempt, I always feel. This is why, like, one would write about death. I'm not at all obsessed with death, but you write about it because, as we know, some French writer said, happiness writes white. If you want to, in the middle of a moment of happiness, well, you wouldn't want to write a poem anyway, and you probably wouldn't want to read one. But you certainly, when things are black, it comes out very clearly on the page, and it may be just a momentary vision, as it were.
Although what strikes me as hearing what you're saying now is that in writing about Seamus Heaney, who's a poet who does very deliberately talk about redress, the redress of poetry is the title of one of his books of essays, and you mention in your essay about one of his poems that he uses the word credit a lot in the sense of voluntarily giving belief, and that's actually something that Milos does as well, the sense that poetry calls on you to believe more, to believe more than you ordinarily would or could in ordinary life. And yet it seems to me that your poetry usually takes the opposite tack, in a sense that I associate with Larkin, as I said earlier, that there is a pleasure and there's a consolation involved, but it's not by telling us things that aren't true. It's more by sympathizing with the reader, with the public, about things that we all experience in common, and often those are very dark things. Sometimes treated with humor, like the poem that you read today, but also sometimes treated very directly and painfully. Mm. So it's almost as though the experience of hearing it from you is what gives it value.
Well, I think when you write, you're always trying to get the thing exactly right. And the reason why people go on writing, and presumably why people go on reading, is because nobody actually gets it quite right. So the redress that James Heaney talks about, he's talking very much, he talks about redress in language as well. And James Heaney says that enough is never enough in poetry. It always has to be more than enough. And that too is a kind of compensation, I suppose. But I suppose the only possible excuse for anybody writing, you know, at my level, say, I mean, like Les Murray is a far more important poet than I am. But you keep writing because you just might have that day, you might have that second, you might get lucky someday. And obviously the great poets, the major ones, are the ones who seem to get lucky virtually every day. The rest of us wait around in hope. And one of the things about poetry, of course, and it's one of the reasons why people delude themselves, I suppose, into devoting their lives to it, is that whereas fiction, for instance, has to be extraordinarily good to survive, poetry, an awful lot of little single poems survive, like single blossoms at the, you know, in a forest or something. And it might just be that a four-line poem, but it could be even a six-line poem which you sold to an insurance company. You'd never know. So you might say poetry is an insurance against mortality.
Well, that actually moves us nicely onto another kind of redress, which comes up a great deal in Irish poetry of the last 30 years, which is political, and specifically about the violence in Northern Ireland, which is a subject that unfortunately is becoming more and more immediate to American readers as well. And I notice that when you write about this subject, and it's a good example in the poem that you read tonight, The 120 Pub, which is translated or after a poem by a Polish poet, and because of that, the specific historical, political background in the Irish situation is sort of shorn away, and it's really about the victim, which is the title of another poem of yours on the same subject. Do you feel that in writing about this, that you deliberately write about the victims rather than the situation as a whole?
Well, I think it's a very dangerous area to get into, the whole area of writing about political topics, because firstly, it's topical and therefore very ephemeral. And that's why a lot of the time, I mean, since we are talking about Healy, it was interesting that after September the 11th, he published in the New Yorker a poem which is a translation of Horace, and it was really to do with this force coming out of the skies. And then after the Iraq war of recent times, he published also in the New Yorker a version of a Sophocles poem about many of the wonders of man and so on, that ends with saying, if you transgress, if you actually treat your enemy badly, then there will be some kind of hubris to be faced. But what I thought was interesting about that is it was a way of saying that you don't need to react to each event topically or immediately. That maybe if a thing is true, then it's true for all kinds of situations. So for instance, when I read that September the 11th, I found that September the 11th radio broadcast, people thought I'd written the poem for September the 11th, whereas in fact it was about 20 years old at the time. And I'm not making any claims for the poem, I'm just saying that if, say, America is now faced with these kinds of topics, and I were advising a poet, which I wouldn't presume to do, but I certainly would say, don't rush into... I mean, if you're moved to do so, by all means, but I think the truths that poetry deals with are always truths of a long perspective. I think the more shorter the perspective, the worse the poem. I think it's not a bad rule of thumb.
Let's move on to a slightly, but maybe only slightly, happier topic, which is work. And particularly, I mentioned, it didn't come up as much, you wrote a long poem of 50-poem sequence, which is almost a sonnet sequence, although the poems aren't sonnets, they're only 11 lines long, I think, called The Bottom Line, which was published separately, and then it's included in one of your books. What is your job, just briefly, tell us about what it is that you do and how you fit that in with writing poetry?
Well, The Bottom Line is the one poem of mine that I actually do like, but I never able to read it because it's 550 lines. I might have tried 540 lines on you, but I definitely wouldn't have tried the 550. It's a sequence about work. I was very surprised I could write about it because, for the reasons I mentioned earlier, when things are changing, it's easy to write about things. But when you do something every day, it's actually so visible to you that, and the language is so commonplace to you, it's quite difficult to actually see it. But I just had one good run with that poem, and it's the one and only poem of mine that I do actually like. And well, my job, I work in the head office of Irish Customs, and I started when I was 16, as you said. My first job was in the debt duties office, so I spent 12 years working on debt duties. I became an expert on everything to do with debt duties and how much you could claim for funeral expenses and reading wills. So a lot of writers asked me to be literary executors, so I've had to stop doing that. I'm going to be spending the rest of my days looking after people's literary estates. And then I worked in stamp duties for about another 10 years, and then I moved on to customs. So really I have two main things that I do now, and God help you sitting listening to what I do all day, but one is a kind of a temporary thing I've been doing for the last couple of years, which is helping the countries of East Europe to improve their own customs, because a lot of the former Soviet republics, their customs wouldn't always be the most non-corrupt, let's say. We won't, and also, they have huge turnovers of staff. So, for instance, if there's a change of government, they often fire all of their customs staff, which is not the way to do it. So along with the other European countries, we try and train them. So I try and persuade people on our staff to go to like Azerbaijan or Turkmenistan or places like that to spend a little while working on some specific topic of customs, like inward processing or valuation or prohibitions and restrictions or something. And the other thing that I do is what are called high-level briefings, so that our customs commissioner and the other high officials, when they go to meetings, of the European Union meetings, I do their briefings, a lot of the briefings for them. I would say what this is all about, what the current position on this topic is and what Ireland should be doing about it, or what we should try and get out of the meeting. So it's a riveting job, as you can imagine.
And that's a full-time, 40-hour-week job. And how do you write? When do you write, for example?
Well, I was always somebody who felt that writing was something you approached with reluctance. In other words, the real test of a poem would be if you kept telling it to go away and it persisted. So obviously the ones in that Purlock poem weren't real poems anyway. Because I think people surrender too easily to the impulse to write. And the way to make sure, it's a bit like kind of those people who won't return phone calls in a love affair. Don't return the phone call to the muse and then see if she rings again. And if she rings maybe twice more, well then you know. So in fact, it doesn't take very much time to write a poem, even a long poem. What takes time are all the ancillary literary things, like I do a fair bit of reviewing, certain amount of radio work, stuff like that. And it's great to have time for that because it takes a lot of preparation and a lot of reading. But the kind of person who tells you that he's a full-time poet is a rogue and a vagabond and not to be trusted in any way whatsoever.
Well, do you feel that you're at an advantage as a critic and also as a poet in not having to make a living from the literary world and the poetry world? Because for an earlier generation of poets, it was actually, there was no choice about it. You had to have a job in Wallace Stevens, William Carlos Williams. Great poets of that generation had jobs. They were lawyers and doctors. Now it's very common for a poet to be a creative writing professor or to be in residency, things like that. Do you ever wish that you did have that kind of career?
No, but I'm interested in the fact that whenever poets get a chance to take those, they always take them. Because it makes me wonder how difficult those jobs are, among other things. But, I mean, like, I've never known any poet who offered one of those. Now, I wouldn't take one personally, I have to say, just superstition again. I've never been to a workshop of any kind, and I've never given one of any kind. And having listened to me tonight, you might say, well, time you signed up. My friend Hugo Williams, the English poet, he gave a reading at some American college, and the professor said to him, we're going to go to the creative writing class in the morning. And he said, was I that bad? But I suppose what you get from a job is you get a context and you get a vocabulary, among other things. That's very valuable. You actually get access to a lot of lives. I suppose I have this, I know we've been, it's a kind of religious theme which kind of worries me running through this thing tonight because it's not usually what we talk about, but there is this kind of Benedictine thing, you know, where they say that to participate in the common lot of mankind is very important. And I really think if poetry has any value, it should be just part of an ordinary life, really. I mean, you think of the Elizabethans and people like that. You think of Sir Walter Raleigh, who, you know, wrote a history of the world. He traveled the world. He might have even discovered this country, virtually, for all we know, and wrote these magnificent sonnets as well. So I think it should be something that, personally, I'm sounding prescriptive now, but for me, it should be part of a life, not their life. It should be, as Miwash says, a dividend from the life. And in that life, the other thing, of course, that's very good about a job is that people don't actually pay any attention whatsoever to poetry, even in Ireland, where it's supposed to be, you know, so popular and that. And you realize, you get a very realistic sense of where this art stands in the life of the community and how peripheral it is. And there's one very practical advantage, which is that when you get a really bad review, nobody at work ever sees it. And in fact, I once got a bad review in the Irish Times, which is about the worst place you can get it because everybody sees it. And it was from somebody I had given a very bad review to, so it was fair enough. And in fact, the poem, now that I remember, that he singled out to show how badly I write was the 6-line poem that the insurance company bought. So you can never be sure. And somebody at work actually said to me, quite honestly and ingenuously, you might say, they said, was that a good or a bad review you got on Saturday? You know, it was like, it left no room for doubt as far as I was concerned. But so it can be refreshing in that sense as well. But I do think that the context is the important bit, to be grounded somewhere in a so-called ordinary existence. Yeah.
Well, the other place that you're grounded is your house, which I read an essay of yours about how you came to live in a house with a view of a graveyard, of a churchyard. How did that happen? Tell us about...
Oh, my God. The research this man does.
That you did work in death duties, and yeah. It all seems to hang together somehow.
I'm dumbfounded by this. Well, I do live, it's true. Actually, the thought occurred to me that being married to an American and living in a house overlooking an old Victorian churchyard was exactly what Ted Hughes had done. So that wasn't a very good... it wasn't a very good precedent, I'm afraid. The first thing I did, of course, was I really was quite squeamish about it. I liked the house, but I hadn't realized until the upstairs was built, because I bought it before the upstairs was built, just how good a view I had of the graveyard. So I thought, this will either make or break me, you know. But what I did was what any half-decent bard would do, which was I purged it by writing very quickly a sequence called Cemetery View, The New Estate. And it actually worked because I don't really look at it anymore, but it did kind of disturb me a bit at the beginning, all right. I don't know whether it's the Ted Hughes bit or the cemetery bit, one or the other, anyway.
I think that's one of my favorite of your poems, and it reminds me of the Gray's Elegy in a Country Churchyard, which is sort of a modern updating of that, and it's very brief, a collection of very brief things, one or two lines, some of them.
Well, Gray didn't go and live in the churchyard.
No, that's right.
He didn't take it quite that far.
He might have been better off if he had. Now, yes. Eastern Europe is something that's come up a number of times, and you've translated a number of Eastern European poets and known many of them. Was that something that you were pioneering in Ireland at the time? Were you one of the first to make contact with Holub and Szymborska and all those?
Yeah, I suppose, but it wasn't. There wasn't a lot of competition, let's say. There wasn't a scramble for that particular seat, as it were, but I just did feel a great identification with them. What I liked about them was how pared back their language was, how ironic their use of language was, and the extent to which they were able to write what I'm calling anti-poems. Because I think we're so used to the poem that's written in a kind of full-throated kind of way, very musical and very... almost rhetorical. And I'm very susceptible to that kind of poem. But I've always felt that the true music for me was really a downbeat kind of music, a music of yearning more than celebration. And I found that note struck very truthfully and truly in those people's work. I really got to know them because, oddly enough, I didn't write to Holub. He wrote to me, and he wrote to correct a fact, which wasn't my fact. It was Joseph Roth had said something about him. Joseph Roth is the wrong man, isn't he? Mm. Joseph Roth, is he the American?
Philip Roth, sorry.
Joseph Roth is the Austrian, yeah. And so I got to know them, but they were very witty, some of these people, in person. But again, Holub was an immunologist, as I said earlier, and the fact that he was, I suppose, working in a job, there was a bit of identification, and I really would urge you to read those people if you get a chance, because I always found when I was in a bookstore that I always reached for their work before I reached for anybody else's, and I don't know why that should be, really.
Well, who are the first? You must have come to them later on. Who are the first poets that you read and who sort of made you want to write poetry?
Well, I was an awful pest, really, because I was talking about Holub writing to me. I was kind of glad to be able to say that, because I used to, as a schoolboy, write to various writers for kind of... So I did workshop them. Like in my sort of teens as a schoolboy, I would have written to people like Auden and Beckett. Because I thought Beckett was an unknown, you see. I went to a play in Tipperary, in the local dance hall. They used to put on plays during Lent, because you weren't allowed to dance during Lent. So they put on Waiting for Godot as something a little more uplifting. And there were about eight people in the audience, of whom I was one. I was say 14 or something at the time, and I just was riveted by this play, and there was nothing in the program note to suggest that anybody had ever heard of Beckett, and I thought somebody should encourage this guy, he really has. So I wrote him, Mr. Beckett a letter. I had this difficulty, the local library helped me to discover that he had a publisher and stuff like this, so I wrote and sort of said, keep up the good work, and keep writing and don't be disheartened and all the rest of it. And he sent me a limited edition of one of his plays, All That Fall, and signed it and put a nice inscription and addressed the envelope and all that. And about 2 months later, he won the Nobel Prize. And I heard this on the news. So I wasn't sure whether it was my letter that had done it or whether he was maybe on his way anyway. But there was that sort of... So I had a habit of... I mean, it was very isolated. It wasn't really a very literary culture. My teachers, you know, normally you're meant to tell the story of the very enlightened teacher who put you on the right path, but I really had very mediocre teachers. And our English teacher couldn't... Well, he called our best-known poet Yeats. He called him Yeats, for instance. He never called him anything else. And I mean, that was as sophisticated as our literary upbringing got. So... In fact, when I left school, what I wanted to do was law, not literature, because we'd been well and truly turned off it, really. So the deputy's office actually sent me to university to do law, which was whatever modicum of education I got was in fact in law, thus making me the ideal literary executor. So should you be looking for a literary executor, you've come
you know
to the right
to find
place
one,
tonight.
Sure.
Yeah. In fact, that may be the only thing that brought you out in the rain tonight.
And what do you make of the state of Irish poetry now? What is the things that we don't know here in America, or maybe only know peripherally, about what's happening?
Well, I suppose every culture is known by only one or two writers. So at the moment in Ireland, those would probably be like Paul Muldoon and Seamus Heaney above all. And so the obvious answer is that there's a lot more happening than would appear to be the case. But I suppose if I were to generalize, I would say it's a conservative literary culture still. Conservative in its subject matter and conservative in its approach to writing. It's still conservative in good ways and in bad ways. The topics would tend to be fairly traditional topics, and they would tend to be treated in a fairly traditional kind of way. So... is that telling you something you don't know? Is it telling you even something you want to know? I'm not so sure. But it definitely is still a literary culture. Even though, despite what I said about my office, there's a great reverence for literature. And people don't... they don't actually think it's a freakish thing to be involved in something like poetry. And they mightn't actually buy the book, but they would respect somebody who did buy the book.
You were telling me earlier, before we came to the theater, a story about the American poet John Berryman, who had spent a year in Dublin late in his life, and how he was remembered in the pub where he used to drink.
Yeah, that's right. I was writing an article for the London magazine about John Berryman in Ireland, and one of the places you had to call if you were writing about John Berryman was the local pub, which is where he spent most of his time. And the pub is called the Beggar's Bush, for reasons which I've never understood. And I went down to the Beggar's Bush with a photograph of Berryman, kind of hangdog thing, and I sort of said, I'm researching this man. And the barman looked at it and he said, oh, that was Mr. Berryman. He's a very old barman. And I said, did you know him? And he said, oh yes, he used to come in here drinking. And I said, I bet he was very loud and boorish, which was Berryman's reputation. And he said, no, Mr. Berryman was an educated man. So that was...
The respect, right, which is not necessarily lacking here, but probably no one would know who he was. That would be the alternate problem. Yeah. Yeah. Do you feel that American literary culture is too professionalized in sort of the opposite way, that it's possible to sort of make your way in a world where everyone does know about literature and never make contact with the outside?
Well, I wouldn't presume to tell America too much about its own literature. What would worry me is at the critical level, the level that you operate at yourself, that the visibility in a culture with so many poets, that, you know, I was speaking earlier about that wish that a poem might survive, that a line or two might survive. But how can that happen in a culture like the American one, where really only a handful of people can possibly be read. There's only time and space to get around to reading so many. And so I worry about that obscure poet in Arizona who really is a genius but who's discouraged, and because nobody has time to read that work. And we talk about the test of time and so on. And I get more and more skeptical about that because, well, firstly, people are actually very oriented towards the contemporary now. And therefore you wonder in the future who's going to take any interest in our contemporaries, as it were. And the second thing is, who on earth is going to go through all those old volumes and work out who did or did not have the kind of talent that it took? When I once was talking to some students who wanted me to do a workshop, which I didn't do, but what we did do actually was I had got my hands on Robert Frost's first book, which was published in England. And at the back of the back cover, it's either his first or his second book, I can't remember which, is a list of all the other poets published by that publisher, none of whom I'd heard of. And I said to them, well, look, if this publisher was enlightened enough to take Robert Frost before anybody else, maybe some of these poets are good poets too. But nobody's ever going to read them. I assigned them, each of them, one of those books, but we never regrouped, so I will never know who the genius on the back of the Robert Frost book was.
Well, this is an unfair question, you don't have to anticipate posterity, but who are the poets now that you read with most pleasure?
Do you mean Americans, for instance?
Or any English language.
Well, it would be kind of invidious, but in America, the people that I have liked include all the obvious ones, but also, I suppose, people like James Schuyler is a great favorite of mine, who's one of the New York School. Stephen Dobbins is a poet that I like an awful lot. I'm going to sort of remember them all when we leave the room here. I bought in Garcia Street Books the new Ruth Stone book, for instance. I'm looking forward to that. I bought some of Arthur Z's books. But the people that I like are usually the people who are actually saying something, but saying it in a way that is musical. I don't necessarily mean formal, but I definitely like there to be lift off in the language in some way. I mean, poetry that just lies heavy and dead on the page isn't really poetry at all. I don't worry whether the rhymes come at the end or where they come. But I think poetry is language really trying to take off. And too much, I think, contemporary poetry just stays dead on the page. It's heard by the poet, but it's not heard by their readers. And I think you should be able to hear poetry on the page as well as see it on the stage. And thank you for making both possible tonight.
That brings us to the end of our time. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you all for coming.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.